Walk humbly with the Lord your God. You know, so that humility is considered a great virtue, okay? And of course we have reference to the idea of anova in many, many different places in the Bible. In other words, humility. And of course, Moshe Rabbeinu, it's written concerning him, Vayish Moshe Anov Miyod, that the man Moshe was very, very humble, more than any other person on the face of the earth.
I understand humility, but
okay,
I don't understand
not being able to look at a woman.
Yeah. As I say, part of the idea of tznius is that you shouldn't go around the thing. This is an interpretation. For example, what we say in Krishna, right? For those asuru, you should not wander literally. In other words, with your eyes, you can go astray. You see, zonim, it's like a zonim, but zonim of course also means somebody goes astray. Okay.
But I get the fact that if you have good thoughts in your mind, you're not, let's say, bad thoughts in your mind, right. You can look at anything and see beauty in it, not be sinning, so to speak.
I know if you remember, we learned some time ago about one of the great Rabbanim, that he was handsome, and he would sit opposite the entrance of the mikveh, so that when the women would leave, they would look at him and they would be able to conceive children who are good looking as he.
Right.
And he did it in Shem Shemayim. He didn't do it because he liked
to
see the women.
Right.
So, in this case, it was justified for him to look at the women. Okay.
The reason I say that is because if one never looks at a woman, one never has the.
To perform the mitzvah of Boruvu
and carry on the Yiddish part.
Okay, well, everything that you say is correct, and this is why, we always felt that the normal state for an adult would be marriage. Smart to come all that people don't get married, so. But nevertheless, the normal state would be the marriage state.
That's what they're saying. But if you don't look at a woman.
Yeah.
I won't argue the point.
You went there Shabbos.
Shabbos, the whole weekend. The next day we went to the Yoda Rebbe.
Where the Rebbe is twice there.
We went on, they had separate buses.
Oh, you mean for the men in one bus and the women in the other?
There was a married couple in the group and they forced to be separated.
Right. Okay.
Is that justified?
If you're among Hasidim, you do what Hasidim do. What am I going to say now? That's their way of life. Why is it, for example, you come to a chasen or a mitzvah, something like that, right? Or even a levaya, and you'll find that the men will sit on one side and the women on the other. Or that when it comes to the dinner, the men are sitting in one side of the room and the women on the other, and there's a mechitz in between.
Thing is, Elaine doesn't want to see somebody, Mr. X, dancing with Mr. Y's wife.
Who doesn't want to see it?
No, that I don't have to tell you.
This, Ben don't want to see it.
I don't know whether that's true.
Has anybody came back from talking to Hashem and you told him that?
Okay, but this is the way it is. You're not going to change it.
No.
You are a chassid, then this is the way you are. Okay. If you're not a chassid, then
I'm
not
a chassid.
Submit yourself a little more. Okay. So this was his interpretation, right? That Zerubbabel is done like so on. In other words, he shuts his eyes in order not to see women and so on and so forth. And as a result, he hits his head against the wall and blood flows.
His face against the wall.
Right. Now the next
that's where the bloodletting comes in, from hitting his face against the wall.
Yeah. He bruises himself.
So okay, that's
the
himself on clop and
so. The bloodletting is the business.
Yeah, right.
Is that a separate category?
No. We're not talking that he goes to a doctor because he's sick and he feels that he has his blood drained from him and he'll feel better.
Nice.
That already is a different story.
Okay.
Yeah. Because that was part of ancient medicine. That's right.
Okay.
It was the medicine that was practiced up until fairly recently. So
leeches, bloodletting.
Right, exactly. Okay,
bonkers.
Yeah.
Okay. The next category of Purush is a Purush Mindukya. Mindukya is like the pestle. We speak about the mortar and the pestle, right?
Oh, yeah.
In other words, the mortar. This is like a cup.
And the pestle is
they pound the thing with. All right, so
pestle, if you take a look,
usually the shape of it is that it has, a place for the hand,
right? And then at the bottom it's usually
round.
I
have one
bigger.
At home.
Right, you have one. All right, so you know what it looks like. Okay.
Yeah.
So the question is, so what is the comparison over here, right? So Omar Rabba Bar Shila said, in Mashba Kimidukya. In other words, when he keeps his head low, like the pestle. In other words, he doesn't want to look up whenever he goes. He only looks down as a sign of humility.
Mm-hmm.
So that, therefore, his head is like the bottom part of the pestle.
Uh-huh.
Okay. The Mashpa says, it's a bihonic prophet. He goes around with his head bent, according to Rashi. Okay. Kimidukya, like a buchla, he says. The three kimakevitz, it's made sort of like a hammer, he says, the rosh hakafa, but the head of it, is rounded. This is the reason. All right, so far we've said all kinds of bad things about these different portions, right? But now about the next categories, there already is a question. Because what is the next category? Next category is Borush, the Pharisee who says, Machoi Vosi Ve'eseno, what is my obligation so that I might fulfill it? So the Gemara says, what do you mean? You're criticizing this? Or Ma Yosehi? This is, on the contrary, something to be praised. The person wants to know, what is my duty, my obligation to perform? What mitzvah do I have to perform? How do I observe this? And so on and so forth. That's something to be praised. It's not something to condemn. So they say, we're not talking about that. All right, so what are we talking about? So they say, Elo de Omar, but this is the person who says, Ma'achod Vasi Su Ve'esen. In other words, so what else do I have to do? Let me know. And the implication is, we'll see. Okay, take a look at the Rashi over there. Right?
Where's the Rashi?
Right opposite. So.
Okay.
See, Porish Machad was here. This is the first one. It says, Manduni, teach me, Ma'olai Latsos, what I have to do there, so I'll do it. So he says, oh, obviously, right? This is a good quality, right? You may know Boki, the Asurim, the Tekhtekhtem Mutsway, to Bodil Moit. If a person, Taka, doesn't know what is a prohibited action, right? Or the fine points of performing mitzvahs, and what's the right way to do it, right? But Bob Ilmon, he wants to come, and he says, tell me what is my obligation so that I can do it, right? That's a praiseworthy, it's a mila in this case, right?
Okay.
Well, not for something to criticize.
Okay.
So, he says, no, what we mean is, in other words, what else do I have to do so let me do it? He says, malasas od, right? In other words, is there anything that I haven't done yet?
Uh-huh.
In the sense of Mare Atmo, and he makes himself appear, Ki Ilu Kiye Mitzako, as if he had already fulfilled all the mitzvahs that he has to do, you see. So that this is what they're criticizing over there. All right, now we come to the next category. Again, they said, right, Porush Mi'avo, and Porush Mi'ira, right? In other words, a Pharisee who serves God out of love, right? And a Pharisee who serves God out of fear. What's so horrible about that? On the contrary, these are things that we should do. Again, these are qualities, right?
Uh-huh.
So, Omule Abaye Verola Latana. So Abai and Rava, when they heard this, they said to the person who recited this, remember we spoke about the word Tana last week, and we said that Tana also had the implication of a person who memorized text. He had a good memory for them, but not necessarily did he understand what he was saying. Okay? So this is the type of a Tana they're talking about over here. Here is a man, he brings a report, he brings, you know, that there are seven categories, and then he starts him to recite the list on himself. So now Abai and Rava are listening to this particular recital, and they said to the person who is giving him the sign, he says, Lord Tisna Porish Miyavo Porish Miyiro. No, they said, don't include in your list over there the one who is a Pharisee either in love or because of fear, right? The Omar Rav Yehuda, as Rav Yehuda said, Omar Rav, in the name of Rav, he says, the Yoylem Yasek Odom the Torah Mitzvahs Atila Shalolishma, that a person should always be involved in performance, in the study of Torah and performance of mitzvahs, even with an ulterior motive. But it's still praiseworthy. Why? Because Shemitov Shalolishma Bolishma, because if he does it originally out of an ulterior motive, but the hope is that what? He'll come to do it for its own sake, because, you know, out of a pure motivation. Okay? So, inasmuch as we're talking about how do we know whether a person's actions are performed because out of conviction or simply out of the fact, you know, that he wants to make others feel that he's doing something, right? He's sort of showing off, you know, his own piety or his learning, whatever it may be. So Omar Rav Nachman by Yitzchak, said, Yimetamro metamro, migalya migalya. In other words, he said that that which is hidden is hidden, and that which is revealed is revealed. Okay? Yeah, right. Okay. So let's take a look first again at guess who? Rashi. Okay. All right. So first of all, Porush Miyavo. Let's talk to that. This particular text prints in big letters. So it's easier to find.
On your right text, yeah.
Not the big one that I have over there, this particular edition printed in Rashi.
The ones that
right,
I
at the beginning, in the big, so it's easier to spot, okay? Yeah. All right, so Porush Miyavo says, Miyavo Sechar HaMitzvahs. In other words, he's doing it not because of love Hashem, you know, that he's being criticized, but he's doing it for the love of the reward for the mitzvahs that he'll get. The lowly avas mitzvahs haboreh, not because he wants to fulfill the mitzvah of Hashem, okay, with the Creator. So that's why they're criticizing him. And how about the Porush, Porush Miyiroi says, shall unshit. He's afraid of punishment. Elo ma al ha'adam la'asos mi'ahavas Hashem mitzvahreh. But what should a person do from the love of Hashem Yisroel, Kasher Tzivanu Hashem Elokeinu, right? Mm-hmm. A person should do whatever God has commanded us to do, v'sof ha'socholavo, and eventually the reward will come, it will be granted by the Rebbeinu Shalom. So then the statement is, right, in the Tamar of the Tamar, Hanistoros Nistoros, he says, that which is hidden is hidden, mibnei yodom, from human beings. In other words, we can't always know what is the character of a person. It's hidden from us, right? The hagluyos, giluyos. But those things that we can see openly, in other words, what they call revealed, but it means, you know, open to everybody that people can see. So they are revealed, all right? From the kolbokim, and now getting back to the text, and then back to the Rashi explanation, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It says, remember, it says, Omar Rav, Metamar, Metamar, Galya, Galya, and says, and then he says, Beidino Rabba, in other words, the court on high, the Supreme Court up in heaven, right, Lispara Mehani de Chofagunde, will exact punishment from those who put on the cloak of being a Talmud Chacham. Okay. Or as Rashi says, in the Kol Mokom, and nevertheless, Levesin HaGodol, right, to the court, literally to the great Supreme Court, to the one on high,
Kulam Galuyas, that even the hidden things will be revealed, right? The Huyiparam in the Hanaskasim Italy says, so that, that court will already exact punishment from those who are simply covering themselves with the cloak of, being talking of piety, whatever it may be, Umar and Atzbon, and they show themselves, Kifrushin, the Yenim Prushin, they show themselves, that is, they put on the air of being Prushin, being Pharisees, right, being Prushin, even though in reality they are not sincere in the Reformation. So, Omalo Yanai Malko, along the same lines, right? So, Omalo Yanai Malko, the Vise. Yanai was one of the kings of the Hashmonaim dynasty. Remember, we're talking about Hanukkah, you know that after the victory of the Hashmonaim, the Jewish people, against the Greeks, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then, Yehuda Maccabi's brother Shimon was the only one who survived all his brothers. The others all died at one time or other in battle. And he was the founder of a dynasty. Okay? What? Yanai was a butcher. He wasn't such a nice guy. I agree with you. Okay? But nevertheless, he was also, he had some Yiddish feeling in him too as well. Okay? So King Yanai said to his wife, it so happened that his wife happened to be the sister of Shimon ben Shetach. So that that being the case, she at least had the connections. Yeah. It's true that he also persecuted the Prushim and so on.
What is Salome?
No. He killed people, yes. But nevertheless, here he says something that's worthwhile, okay? So he said, to his wife, he said, Al tisyori min ha-prushim velo min bishen ha-prushim. He says, do not be afraid either of the Pharisees or of those who are not Pharisees. Eliminat zvuyin. But rather, you should be afraid of those who are hypocrites. Okay? Tzvuyin means literally those who are painted. But those who are hypocrites, shedomim the prushim, right, who appear as though they are prushim. Shema'atzehen kema'atzeh zimri, because they perform deeds like zimri, mevakshan sachar, but they seek reward, kepintas. These have become proverbial expressions, okay? The word sabua, for a hypocrite, this has become standard in Yiddish as well. Yeah. And particularly, the idea of, that they do the deeds of Zimri and seek the reward of Pinchas. Of course, this is a reference to what? It's a reference, to the story where Zimri went and he cohabited with the daughter of Moab, right? And then, of course, Pinchas was the one, who was zealous for God, and then he killed him, right? But we're not talking about, we're talking the fact that, they do deeds as heinous as Zimri, right? And yet at the same time, and of course, but they're doing it, what? Secretly they're doing it, right? But openly, they want the reward of Pinchas, because, outwardly, they give the appearance of being big tzaddikim.
So if these are the categories of Purushim, okay?
Yeah, who are being condemned, but nevertheless, there are also Purushim who are absolutely sincere, right? And that they do serve the Rabbeinu Shel Olam Miyavo, or Miyiro, or whatever.
Why are they mentioned, or why are they not mentioned here?
Why are they not mentioned here? Because over here, they're giving a list of people who are being criticized. But it doesn't mean that ergo everybody's being criticized.
Mm-hmm.
It's only these people who perform acts of evil,
mm-hmm.
or whatever, they have the wrong motivation in their hearts, but at the same time, they want to give themselves, the air of being pious, so that people will show them honor or whatever it may be and so on, while at the same time how they act secretly is already a different story. Yeah. look. The person who deserves covet, the Gemara says, covet will run after him.
Right.
But if you run after covet, it's going to elude you. Okay? All right. New Mishnah. Yeah. Rabbi Shimon Eiman. Rabbi Shimon says, Ein Zchus Toile B'Mayim Amorim. He is of the opinion that the Zchus, in other words, merit, is not going to set aside the verdict of the Mayim Amorim, or the bitter one. Okay? If you remember, in the previous Mishnah, they were talking about the fact that it is possible for a woman, even though she has sinned, that because of the good deeds that she has performed, the mitzvahs and so on that she's had, so that therefore it might postpone the punishment for a year or 2 years or 3 years, is what we learned, okay? And we also learned that, some of the rabbis said that, that being the case, a woman should be taught Torah, because that too will be a protection for her in case she sins, and it will protect her also from the effects of the Mayim HaMorim. Okay? Rav Shimon is absolutely opposed to this entire concept that there is such a thing as postponing the punishment. Why? Well, we'll see in a second. Why? What? Yeah, well, it's a mitzvah, isn't it? So it has the same effect. But remember, we said that Torah is a far greater protection than mitzvah, because mitzvah, the effect is temporary, but you stop doing the mitzvah, then but with Torah there are more lasting results. Okay, all right. So Rabbi Shimon Oimer in Zchus Teil B'Mayim Amorim says Zchus merit doesn't work. It's not going to postpone the effects of the Mayim Amorim. Yimato Omer Zchus Teil B'Mayim Amorim, because if you say that merit will enable a woman, to have the punishment suspended, right? Then in that case, then you know what the result is going to be? First of all, it means that you're going to cause all women to cast doubts upon the efficacy of the Mayim HaMa'orim, right? In other words, even if women have sinned and they do it, but all women say, so what? Look, she does a good deed, so what? What's it? So
it's a big deal, right?
Yeah, but not only that, then it means that automatically the next statement is going to be true. Right? And at the same time, you're going to cause, the reputation of the women who are tahoros, in other words, the women who have not sinned, right, to be blackened. Even though they're going to Mayim HaMa'orim, right? She'omrim, because people will be saying, Tameo saying, they sinned, they committed adultery, right? Elo she'tol salahen zchus. But, the reason why we don't see any results is because they have merit, that to postpone it. So automatically it means that they're going to condemn all women.
All women.
Right.
Guilty or not guilty.
Right, guilty or not guilty. All going to be, smeared with the same brush, so to speak. Okay? So that's why he says no such thing as a Zchus Teil. Rabbi on the other hand says, HaZchus Teil B'Mayim HaMorim, says merit does have an effect when a woman drinks the Mayim HaMorim. Ve'eino yoledes, right? She won't give birth, because we said that if she is if she's innocent, then she will be blessed with a child, right? All right. So this woman being guilty, but not, the effects are not immediate because she has chus, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she won't give birth. Okay. They ain't no mashpachas, and not only that, but also her physical condition isn't going to get any better. We said before, that if she is actually guilty, then her physical condition should become very bad, right? The face becomes green, belly swells, etc., etc., and so on. Okay. So this woman, her physical condition is never going to get any better. On the contrary, of course, it's understood, it will, as time goes on, get worse, which is what he says. Elenis nav navaholeches, right? but rather it's going to continue to deteriorate. Okay? And the soul pimeisa biosamisa. And finally, she will die the same death that would have happened, you know, if she didn't have the merit. But it will be postponed. This is what Rebbe says. Okay? All right. Now, the next part of the Mishnah deals with some technicalities. Okay? So let's listen to what these technicalities. All right? So let's learn some of these technicalities that we have over here. All right. First technicality is, remember, we said that the sota, as part of the testing business, right, not only does she sing the Maim HaMorim, but what else does she have to do? She has to bring a mincha, right? Only that this is the mincha sota, it's not exactly the same as all the minochos. It's others which are made out of, you know, fine flour and so on. And this one, remember, is from barley and not brought in b'chobetika kele, you know, to bring it to the Beis HaMikdash and so on. Okay. So, here is some technicalities that we have. Nitmeis minchosa. Let's say that the mincha became tummy, came in contact with something or other that made it tummy. Could be maybe a crawling creature or something like that, you know, came in contact with it, right? Ad shelo kotcha bichli, and this happened, that the mincha became unclean before it actually was put into one of the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash itself, which of course, this is what we mean by kotcha, requires the status of holiness, right? So in that case, harehi kecholam menochis, in that case it's like all other menochas, as far as the rule is concerned, namely, that if they become tomei prior to being put in a kli shoreis, then what happens? The sipode, then they are sold, they are redeemed for money, and eventually the money will be used to buy a good...
What's that word?
Sipode. Pidyon. No, pidyon?
Yeah,
redemption, right?
Redemption.
Yeah. Right. So that they will be redeemed, which means, you know, they'll be redeemed for money, and the money then is used in order to buy, another mincha. But this mincha by itself is no good anymore, okay? The yimisha kotcha, bichli. However, what happens if it became tummy after it had already been put into one of the Beis HaMikdash kelim, right? Then harehi kekol ha-menochas. Then the rule for this is the same as for all other menochas which become tummy once they have already been consecrated in one of the kelim. And what is the rule over there? This is sorev. Then in that case, if it's tummy, then it has to be burnt. Then the Mishnah continues. It says, "V'elu shemin chaseihan nisrafos." And here is a list of cases where the mincha is burnt. In other words, it's no good. It's invalid and it's burnt, destroyed. Right. First case that's mentioned is Oimeres Tamei Ani L'cha. Right. A woman says, "I admit that I have committed adultery against her." All right, so in that case, we destroy the mincha. Right, she admits it. Right. Or edim shehi tameyon. Or she didn't say it, but witnesses come, right, that she committed adultery. Okay?
Yeah, a good case again.
Yeah. Behol meris. Or if the woman says, eini shosa, I'm not going to drink. And Rashi points out that it doesn't mean necessarily that, that. She doesn't say I am tameyo, that I have committed adultery, but I simply do not want to drink the Mayim HaMorim. So in that case, what do? Throw her
out.
Of course, yeah. We did learn that if they went through everything, including the reading of the Megillah and the wiping out of the lettering and everything else, then in that case, she's forced to drink. But this is still a prior state at which you could stop the action completely, okay? So she says, I don't want to drink, that's all, Father. The cutoff point is, we learned before that when they write the Megillah and they, you know, then they wash it and into the Mayim HaMorim. That's the cutoff point. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Once they write the Megillah.
Right, right. Yeah. Even if the Megillah was written, but it was not yet, erased in the water, right?
Even if it wasn't put in the water?
Yeah. No.
then at that point, that's the final cutoff point, so to speak. Okay? So at any one of these stages, there are cutoff points. Okay? Or v'shebaloyin rotzei l'hashkeisa. It could be that the husband doesn't want her to drink the mayim haborim, whatever reason it may be. Yeah? It's a good question, why? But maybe he changed his mind and he says, I don't want to go through it. He doesn't say anything.
No.
So, the husband decides that he's not going to force her to do this, right? Or another category is something that we had before. Remember that they were supposed to be escorted by Talmidei Chachamim to make sure that they didn't have any intercourse on the way to Yerushalayim, right? But somehow they gave these guys the slip.
and stuck off in the bushes.
Right. And they had intercourse. So in that case, I mean, that's the end of it. It's not going to prove anything.
That proves it already.
Right.
That he's unfaithful.
Right. And then, okay, now we go into another business. Still concerning Mincha, but this time not necessarily concerning a Sota, but a general rule concerning Menachos. Okay. Correct. So that stops the process, period. That's all. That's it. That's the end of it. Okay? No. If the husband says that I don't want it also. Okay? I mean, there are various ways. I mean, we just said before. No, but don't you see, there's supposed to be witnesses over there. The two guys, the two Talmidei Chacham were supposed to escort them from the local Beis Din to Yerushalayim, you understand? And I see that, the two of them went into the same room together, okay? That's enough. Two of them went, doesn't mean that they have to catch them in the bed.
That's perfect.
Right. But they went into the same bedroom, so automatically you assume that that's right. Well, all right, look, the point we don't have to spend too much time in arguing. But the point of the matter is that should stop the process immediately. Okay?
Right.
All right. Now, as I say, we come to another technicality. All right. When women are married to Kohanim, then Minchosehem is lost. Then, in that case, their Mincha is burned. Now, what are we talking about over here? We're not talking necessarily about a sofa. But there is a rule in the Torah that says that, okay, normally with a mincha we know that what happens, that part of it, right, the kohen takes a komitz, he takes a handful from the flour, right, and the lavona and the frankincense that's there, and he burns it on the mizbeach. But what happens to the rest of it? The rest of it is eaten by Kohanim. They can make it into cakes or cookies or bread or do whatever they want, okay? But it's theirs.
You're talking about the barley now.
Huh?
The barley. Or the flour.
Flour. I'm talking about in general.
In general.
Okay.
Okay.
That's why I said that this
doesn't refer to
this. This is a general rule right now that they bring in over here. Okay, since they're talking about menachos, so they throw it in also for good measure, okay? All right. So, but there is an exception. An exception is that if a Kohen brings a mincha, then in that particular case, there the rule is kolil toktar. It has to be burned completely.
He's bringing a mincha for himself.
Right, for himself, exactly. Okay? All right. Now, bearing that in mind, then what if it's, Mrs. Kohen? You understand?
Mm-hmm.
And she wants to present a mincha. So in that case too, what is it? Does it follow the rule of the ordinary mincha that any other woman would bring? Namely, part that's burnt on the altar and the rest of it eaten by the Kohanim, the Shirayim, as we would say. Or does it follow the rule of a Kohen that it has to be burnt completely? And there is no separation of Shirayim or anything like that. You understand?
So what is the answer?
All right. So, the rule over here, it says, okay, Kol HaNesuras LeKohanim, right. that women who are married to Kahanim, then Minchotei Nesrafos, then their Minchot is burnt on the altar.
Also.
Why? They're completely burnt. Why? Because the rule that applied to the husband would apply
to the woman.
To them. Okay. And therefore, the Mishnah continues and it says, Bas Yisrael Shenisa is the Kohen, Minchot Nesrafos, right? That the daughter of a Yisrael who is married to a Kohen, then automatically she assumes that status and her mincha, right,
yeah.
The status of a Kohen, so that the mincha is burnt. How about the Kohenes, the daughter of a Kohen, Shenisa the Yisrael, who is married to an Israelite, right?
Mm-hmm.
Aposha the Yid, as we would say, right? Then in that particular case, you know, so we say, In that case, the mincha is eaten. In other words, as we explained, in other words, whatever is left
like
over
an ordinary
is
mincha.
Eaten. Exactly. So the fact that she was the daughter of a kohen, that doesn't affect her, even
but
though
she, again,
as long as she wasn't married, you understand?
She assumes the status
right,
of
she's still in the category of being a kohen. Right. But
no.
The minute she's married, then she's no longer
right.
Okay. Then it says, Ma ben kohen the kohenes. Right? So tell me, what is the difference between a male Kohen and a female Kohen? Right? Understand? So it says, Minchas Kohen is Necheles, and Minchas Kohen is Necheles. The first one is what we've already said, namely, that the Mincha brought by the daughter of a Kohen who is married to an Israel, right, to Israel, is eaten, and the Mincha of a Kohen is not, has to be burnt completely.
Right.
Kohen is Mitchalel, that's another difference. If the daughter of a Kohen has relations with a man who is not suitable for her, namely a mamzer or something like that, okay?
So.
Then in that case, she becomes disqualified, so to speak. She becomes, right. But Kohen, a Kohen, even if what? Even if he fools around with a grusha, right? Or an almana? Well, an almana is all right, I mean, unless he's a kohen gadol.
Yeah.
But let's say with the grusha he falls.
Yeah,
or a chalol.
Yeah,
it doesn't make him a chalol. It makes his
offspring.
His son, his offspring will be a chalol, but it doesn't affect him. Okay? It's not a great example of what a kohen should be, but nevertheless, as far as his own personal status is concerned, he has not become a chalol through it. But his offspring becomes chol.
What
is a grusha
again?
A grusha is a divorced woman. Okay. Kohenes v'tamo l'meisim. Yenkeim v'tamo l'meisim. This, of course, a practical ruling. The daughter of the Kohen, you know, she observes mourning like any ordinary person. In other words, she can go to the cemetery and things like that. Okay? Whereas a Kohen is not allowed to be Matami the Mason, except where the Torah commanded that he has to. Okay?
Unless it's
that's right. You know, his own immediate family, that's one thing. But let's say to go to a Levi or something like that, or go to the cemetery, a Kohen doesn't do it. Okay. Kohen Oicha B'Kotche Kodoshim, Yen Kohen is a Kotche Kodoshim. Kotche Kodoshim, the Holy of Holies, this is in reference to three types of korbanos. The chatos and the osham, well, those are the two major ones, because the oila nobody eats. The oila has to be
burned
completely.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the chatos and the osham, I'll have to add a third one, because we said, if you say Rabbi, we say Ezel Makomon, and that is the bechor. Firstborn animal, which is given to the Kohen. So those have to be eaten only by whom? By Zichrei Kohuna. Only by males.
Family.
Because it's written, the Torah calls a Chor.
Only the male will family?
Only males.
Oh,
only
okay.
Males are allowed to eat.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So those sacrifices can only be eaten by male Kohanim, but the female Kohanim are not allowed to. Okay? All right, I think I'll stop at this point. It's already after 9 o'clock.
All right.
So we'll continue with the rest of this Mishnah next time and continue from this.
So we're now on.
We're now
Kof
Gimel, Amud Aleph, in the middle of the Mishnah at the top of the page. And next week we'll continue with Mardain Ishla Isha. What is the difference between a man and a woman? Well, I think the biology they know. But we'll discuss what are some differences in dinim that affect men as compared to dinim that affect women.
Yeah.
Okay?
Okay, sound like
Wednesday. Yeah, we'll meet next Wednesday, even though it's New Year's Eve, but what the heck. It's not like Little, where there is something of a tradition. Hey, you want to give the date? The date tonight is New Year's Eve. December 31st, 1997. Tomorrow is a new year already. Anyway, we now continue with the Mishnah Chof Gimel, Amid Aleph.
Right.
All right. So the Mishnah says, Ma Bein Ish LeIsha. What are some differences in dinim between a man as compared to a woman? Again, this doesn't go to a complete list, but it just lists certain differences between them. Well, difference number one: O ish porea uforem, v'en hoisha poras uforemes. All right. So, here we are talking about a person who suffers from leprosy. Okay. Once a person suffers from leprosy and is declared to be a leper, then in that particular case, one of the things that he has to do is to porem, which means that he tears his garment, and porea means that he has to upset his hair and so on.
Shave his head.
Shaving is later, but this is right. Okay, this is what he has to do. So a man who suffers from leprosy has to observe these things, okay? But a woman who suffers from leprosy, in Isha right for us, she does not do these two things. Okay? Another difference. This is a very peculiar din, I have to tell you. Okay? A man who dies, but prior to his death, he was a Nazir to begin with, okay?
What?
Prior to his death, he was a Nazir.
Nazir, okay.
Okay. And he set aside the animals that would be brought as sacrifices when the Naziris was over, and he died. He died before. So he could make his son assume the obligation of being a Nazir and use those sacrifices. Okay?
Could force the son.
Yeah. Okay, but on the other hand, a woman who is a Nazira, she cannot do that to her son. Okay? It's the difference between the man and the woman.
So, you mean a woman can also take the pledge that
a woman can also decide to be a Nazira, right? There's no question about that. But, if she decides that she wants to refrain from drinking wine and letting her hair grow and so on and so forth, she has that privilege. But she cannot force her son to do the same as the husband could do.
Okay.
No, definitely not. Okay?
Okay?
Yeah. Then, Ish Begalea Kal Naziris Ovid is also along the same line, okay? That man has to shave his head, if you remember, when, if his father had told, had committed him to become a Nazir.
Yeah.
So the day that he becomes, ready to get back into the fold, so to speak, to live a normal life, he has to come to the base of Mikdash, and of course one of the things that he has to do is to shave off all his hair. That he has to do. But the woman does not do that. Okay? She retains her hair. Even if the father has said that. Okay. Then O Ish Bekadesh is Bito, the Eno Ish Bekadesh is Bito. According to the law in the Torah, the father has the right to betroth his daughter to a man as long as she is either a ketana, which we said is up to the age, up to the age of 12 years and one day, or even if she is a nara.
Nara is a girl, if you remember, in that period between, 12 years and one day, and 12 years and 6 months. Okay. But once it's 12 years and 6 months and the day after, then we said the woman becomes a bogera, she becomes an adult woman. And in that case, the father loses his authority to be Makadish. So that, you know, because she, at this point, she has the right to choose herself as to whether she wants to marry or not.
So they probably married them off young.
Huh?
That's why they probably
married. In many cases they did. Look, I mean, we're all aware of the fact that not everybody lived to, as long a lifespan as we do today.
That's right.
Yeah. So that, therefore, once...
Is this a big scandal in the North?
Yeah. Some Mishagoyim over there. I don't know what they are. Unfortunately, even among Jews, we have a few crackpots.
No kidding. Unfortunately.
It's unfortunate. They come out with the craziest things. Unfortunately, we also get the publicity.
Publicity, right. Good things don't get the publicity.
Right. So, according to the law of the Torah, then, as we said, then, a man has the power to be Makadish his daughter, okay, during that time, as we said, up through the time that she's a daughter. But the Eino Isha Makadish his daughter. But a woman point is because of the fact, what happens, for example, if the husband dies, okay? Father is the girl dies, and the mother is left with a minor daughter, or let's say even a nara, but let's say a minor daughter, because that doesn't apply anymore to a nara, okay? But this particular situation could apply to a katana, okay? She has sort of a quasi authority to engage, that is to betroth the daughter, she and her sons, in other words, the brothers. It's not an absolute authority. When the girl reaches the age of being a nara, in other words, when she reaches the age of puberty, then in that case she has the right to go to the Besdin and be Mama Ennis. In other words, this is what we call Miyan, or she can be Mama Ennis, which is the verb. She can say, I refuse to live with this man, I don't want this, and the Besdin automatically dissolves the marriage.
Oh,
yeah.
And so, in other words, if she's already married or betrothed, she's married anyway.
Right. Yeah. By betrothal, remember, technically there was a difference, as I've pointed out many times, between Kiddushin or Emerson, as compared to Nisuin. That in the one case, she's already married in the sense of being an Ashes Ish, but they have not yet begun to live together. Right. With Nisuin, then this is real marriage. Okay. But in any case, even if it's Emerson, to dissolve that union would require a get. Even though they haven't begun to live together, okay? I guess you could sort of consider it like something like an annulment, although it's not exactly the same thing. Right?
We're not talking about. We started off talking about a Nazarite.
No. These are all general rules.
General rules,
right. Then another difference is for Ish Borcheres Pito, in Ish Borcheres Pito. Remember, we have a section in the Torah where a man can sell his katana, his daughter, who is still a minor, as a shifcha, as a maidservant, right? And then this is for a period up to the time that she becomes, that she shows signs of puberty, okay? And the point is that at that particular point, she gains her freedom, unless either the man to whom the father sold the girl, or his son, marries her. If they marry her, then she's a married woman like any other married woman.
But she can refuse.
Yeah, she can refuse. She can refuse to be married as long as, you know, she... For financial reasons, exactly. He wants the money that he gets immediately from the sale. It's exactly what it is. Naturally, if he wants to redeem her, then he has to pay back.
But if she reaches puberty,
yeah,
she becomes let's say she reaches the age of 12 yeah. and a half in one day, she's already a vulgaris.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But even if once she becomes a nara, even
a nara, she can also say I want out.
Absolutely, no question. In fact, automatically she goes out free, and of course it goes out free, but. At the same time, he has to compensate her too, you know, like when a slave finishes the 6 years of service or whatever it may be, then, you know, it's written Hane Tanik law, right, that you have to give him extra. You don't, you know, just say, okay, goodbye Charlie, right, or goodbye...
If, let's say, the father sells his daughter,
right,
the person to whom she sold, one of the sons marries her,
huh? Right.
When he marries her, and then she gets to the age of 12 and a half, and she says, I don't want to live with her anymore.
Well, that's a good question.
What happens then?
Technically, I guess, we require a divorce.
Yeah.
No, you see, because that's not the same as the other case, where, because here the father did sell her, and the idea of selling is not just for money, but it's also with the idea that eventually. Either the Baal, in other words, the master, or the son would marry her, okay? Because this was one way of, you know, working out.
But she doesn't have to be a certain age before.
That's correct. Yeah, technically, right. Of course, afterwards we learned in Gemara, in Kedushin, that they frowned upon the whole idea of minors getting married. It's a Tosfos that we learned, right? But according to the law of the Torah, you see. So, in other words, circumstances caused the rabbis to modify some of these things, okay? But the Mishnah is still talking over here what the law of the Torah would be, that these differences apply. Well, they're different, okay. This called Orum. Or Rome should be more correct in pronunciation. The English in the skill is Aruma. Okay? The din is that if a person is sentenced to stealing, capital punishment, right? Because remember, there are different types, okay? But the rule is that if it's stoning, right? So in that particular case, the man has to be stripped bare except for a little loincloth, you know, to cover his genital area. Okay. But in the case of a woman, it's not so. She is not stripped bare. Instead, they give her a garment that will cover her body. Okay. The basic reason, of course, we had that. I think we had it once in Marcos or something. I'm not sure. Certainly,
the Lawrence had been passed, anyway.
And over there, the basic reason is that they want to hasten the death, and so therefore they figure, you know, that by stoning the man when he's bare, he'll die more quickly than if he had a garment, you know, which would deflect.
Prevent the wound.
Right. And the idea was incidentally to spare him further agony, you see. That's why they wanted to hasten his death. But in the case of the woman, her modesty has to be preserved. So therefore, in her case, this is why she is not she wears a garment. Okay? And then there's a similar din that follows. It says also the ha'ish nisle, the inner isha nisleis. After the stoning, then the next step after that is that they take this person and they hang him.
Even after he's stoned?
After he's been stoned and dead. Why? It's only for a moment that they do it. They put him up on a post and then they take him down again. But the reason being, because it's written, you know, that if a person murders somebody else, right, then the soliso also aleis, you are to hang him on
literally a tree or something. It doesn't mean a tree, though. Because what they did, they had a post, they would tie the person to it, right? And this was considered hanging, because it wasn't done for strangulation, you understand? That's not the same as chenik. This was simply as part of public disgrace, so to speak, but also that because of the fact that he had suffered disgrace, then that the Rabbeinu Shaddam should have mercy upon him and forgive his sins. This was the basic idea. All right, so a man who is stoned, then he is also hanged afterwards. However, v'yein ha'ishanisles, you don't do this to a woman, okay? Even if she's been stoned, because, you know, if she deserves stoning as a punishment, but nevertheless, you're not going to hang her afterwards. Again, it's not proper, okay? And another case over here, ha'ish nimka b'gnevoso, v'yein ha'isha nimkeres b'gnevoso. If a man steals, okay, so you know that the law of the Torah is not don't put him in jail, but the law of the Torah is that he has to repay what he has stolen. Not just repay, but in many cases he has to pay double the amount, or if it were, you know, a sheep or an ox, then in that case it would be either fourfold or fivefold. Okay, but the basic idea is repay. And what happens if the guy, you know, squander the money that he got from stealing and he doesn't have it anymore? So in that case, then the Bezdin has the power to sell him as a slave in order to work off, you know, what it is that he did steal.
Slave,
okay,
the person found that he stole from?
Yeah,
it could be anybody.
But the point is that the money is being used in order to repay what has been stolen. Okay, so a man, you can, right, the Bezdin can force a man to do that, but it cannot force a woman to do that. So this is what the Mishnah is telling us right now. Okay, all right. Well, so you will learn a couple of more minutes and we'll call it a night. Okay, Tana Rabbanan, our sages have taught us. All right, now you see what the Mishnah, what the Gemara is going to do now is to go over these various phrases and try to find a reason why. Okay, so Tana Rabbanan, call Hanisuas the Kohuna. Right, we said that women who are married to a Kohen, min chosehen is ruffles, right? Then the menachas are burnt completely instead of, as we said, partly on the altar and partly to the kohanim. Okay, so ketzak, how does this work out? It says kohenes leviyah the Yisraelis, whether she is the daughter of a kohen or the daughter of a Levi or the daughter of an Israelite, right? She nisays the kohen and she's married to a kohen, and in that case ein min chaso necheles. Her mincha is not to be eaten, as we said, by the God. Why? So the Gemara says, "Bipnei sheyesh lo chelik ba, the eino ole kolil. Bipnei sheyesh lo chelik ba." Okay. The reason is that first of all, the Kohen also has a share in this mincha of his wife. It's sort of like community property, so to speak. Okay. So since he has a share, right? Then in that particular case, that it should become kolil, right? It should be burnt,
yeah,
completely. All right. But nevertheless, the eino oile kolil, nevertheless, you cannot burn it completely where? On the altar. This is the idea, right? Why? Because she has a share in it too. So what happens in this particular case? So Elo HaKometz Korei Bi'atzmo Ashiraim Kerevim Bi'atzmo. In other words, the final disposition of this mincha is that the kometz, in other words, what I said, the handful that the kohen takes from the flower of the mincha, that is burned on the altar, right? But Ashiraim, whatever is left, so Kerevim Bi'atzmo, they're going to be burnt separately in a different area, right? And as we'll discover, where is it going to be burnt? It's going to be burnt in what they call the Beis Hadesh, in other words, the place where after sacrifices, you know, where if something becomes tummy or something, so they had an area over there where they could burn
dump it, yeah.
They dump it, right, and then they burnt it over there. All right, so he says, Ikri Khan, why don't you read over here? Koshum in Menu Le Ishim, Arehu Beval Taktiru. So they say, why don't we apply a rule over here which says as follows, that when there is something, part of the animal has to be sacrificed on the altar, right? Then in that case, the rest of it is not in the category of being burnt on the altar. We said before that, let's say in the case of Shlomim, okay? Case of the Shlomim, everybody gets a share in it, right? The Mizbeach has its share. People who brought it, they have their share. And certain parts are given to a Kohen, okay? So we said, you know, the chazah, the breast, and one of the polkas, okay? One of the legs, right, of the animal, right? They're given to the Kohen, okay? So that's their share.
Yeah.
All right. So the idea of this principle that we just enunciated is that if part of the animal has to be burnt, part of the sacrifice has to be burnt on the altar, then in that case, the rest of it has to be assigned to whatever it's meant to be assigned, and you cannot take another part of the animal, whatever it is, and also burn it on the altar. It's confined only to those things that specifically have to be burnt. Right, that's for example, the Torah mentions, yeah, I mean, what's earmarked? Like the chalev and the lobe of of the liver, Yisaris HaKoved, this has to be burnt on the altar, okay? But you cannot then take another part, let's say the part that should go to the Kohen, and burn it on the altar. You can't do that. Well, the idea over here then, therefore, is if we say that here we have a case where, you know, part of it, the chometz, is burnt on the altar, then shouldn't the rest of it
also
be eaten by the Kohanim and not what? And not burnt on the altar.
Yeah, he's already taken it.
Right, right. So it's going contrary to this particular principle, right? So obviously there's a conflict over there. So Omar Yehuda, Bereid Rab Shimon ben Pasi. So Yehuda, the son of Shimon ben Pasi, said, "The Masik Lehu L'Shemaitzim." He says, "You know what they do? They burn it, but not on the altar. Instead, they burn it as if you would be burning firewood. In other words, they'll take the shirayim and they'll simply burn it, and because we said that, you know, it has to be completely burnt, right? They cannot, the Kohanim have no share in eating it. So what about this part, the shirayim that's left over of the mincha that we said, you know, has to be burnt? So they take it and they burn it someplace else as if it were firewood." Okay. And this is Rabbi Elazar, the Tanya Rabbi Elazar Omer, and this would be in accordance with the opinion of Rabbi Elazar, who said that the words the reach nichoach, in other words, for a sweet savor, literally, is the way they translate in English, biato male, right? In other words, that you're not allowed to offer up as a sacrifice. So you are permitted to burn it, however, as if it were firewood. Okay. So Hanichal Rabbi Elazar, if we go according to the system of Rabbi Elazar, so he says the Islay Haisboro, he holds this opinion, so it's good, God's good. Elul Rabbanon, but what about the rabbis? The Leslu Haisboro, who do not apply this principle. So my equal amendments, and what can you say over there? So the answer is the Adilahu Rabbi Elazar Shimon. They do like Rabbi Elazar Shimon. The Tanya, as we learned, Rabbi Elazar Shimon Omer, are komets, right? The komets, in other words, what the Kohen has taken, the handful, korei biatzmo, that's burnt separately, the ashirayim, and the other things is mispasim, and they're going to be scattered on Beis Hadeshen, the place where other burning takes place, but not on the altar itself. All right, we'll stop at this point at the bottom of the page. Okay, now Is it better to meet at 7:30 or at 8
o'clock?
8 o'clock. You like 8 o'clock?
Yeah.
Okay, then that'll be it. All right. Close
to make.
Court. Okay.
All right, we're on.
All right, so now on the top of Chof Gimel, Amud Beis, all right? Okay. And tonight is the 7th of the month of January.
1998.
Right. All right. So the Gemara finishes the discussion of that little particular sugya, and it says, "Vafilu Rabbanon lo pligi aleid Rabbi Elazar ben Shimon." It says that even the rabbis, who we said before, don't have necessarily the same mesoris, in other words, the same tradition that he comes with, but nevertheless they are in agreement with him, namely what? That under these circumstances the mincha is going to be burnt. Right? And it will be scattered over the you know, the Beis Hadesh. Okay? So it says they were in disagreement with him only in one case. Elo v'minchas chote shel kohanim. This is only in the case of a mincha which is brought by a kohen who is guilty of having committed some trespass, and he wants to bring a chatas. This is what they mean by the minchas kohen, minchas chote. Okay. You know that if a person, through ignorance or something like that, committed a transgression, and then afterwards he realizes the fact that he had committed a transgression, so in the days that the Beis HaMikdash was in existence, then what did he do? He would bring a chatas in order to atone. Okay? But if he's bringing a chatas, then in that particular case, you know, so that the animal, of course, is going to be partly burnt on the altar, but the other part, as I said before, is going to be eaten by the kohanim. Right. But in addition, he could also bring a mincha, in addition to the animal. Okay? Now, inasmuch as we said before, what? That the mincha of a kohen has to be completely burnt, right? So in this particular case, what is the ruling? The ruling is that here, the mincha schote shel kohanim, the bas hakrovahi, right? There's no question that the whole thing then has to be burnt on the altar. Because he is a kohen, and this is, you know, the kohen is bringing is for that purpose.
Right.
But in any other case, as for example, let's say it was a mincha sota or something like that, then afilu rabbanan, then even the rabbis in agreement what? That even according to the way the laws of Rabbi Shimon says that you burn it, and but the ashes are scattered on the base of Hadeshin, and it's not to be handled like an ordinary mincha, as we said before. Okay, now the last part of the Mishnah dealt with different things, and at this point they are explaining now what it was. Okay, if you'll take the last part over there. All right, it's the last part beginning with, okay, first of all it says no minchas kohen, we already explained over there. Now, we said Bas Yisrael HaNesua, right?
Yeah.
Daughter of an Israelite who was married to a kohen and so on and so forth. Okay. The question is, why, if she was born an Israeli, Israelite, whatever you want to call her, she was born a Yisrael, okay? Or Yisrael. But she's married to a kohen, right? Then why should her mincha be burned completely? So the answer is, they say, it was in my time of the Makra, because the pasuk says, "We call minchas kohen kol yom tiyeh," right? Lo seyachel, right? So it, the mincha of a kohen has to be burned completely and cannot be eaten. That's kohen, it says. But below kohenes, but not the daughter of a kohen. If she marries, in other words, in Israel, and she has to bring a mincha, whatever it may be, she's no longer a kohen in this respect, and therefore her mincha is treated like the normal rule for a mincha.
Declassed.
Well, declassed. I don't like that term. We're only facing a fact of life. I mean, that after all, I mean, a woman who marries, you know, normally assumes the status of her husband, that's all. So it works in all directions. There's only one direction that they don't mention. Look, after all, they can't mention over here each and every single exception. But there is an exception that we see even our own everyday life. You know what I'm talking about? Pinyin HaBen.
Pinyin HaBen, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what is the din as far as Pinyin HaBen is concerned? Who is required? If the mother happens to be, for example, the daughter of a Kohen or even the daughter of a Levi, then there's no Pinyin HaBen. The father does not redeem the child. Of course, we're not talking about where the father himself was even a Kohen or Levi. That's understandable, yeah. But even if the wife is the daughter of a Kohen or a Levi, then in that case, there's no Pinyin HaBen. So there's still a remnant, you know, of that particular status. But that's about the only area in which I could think of it right
now.
So
if the mother is a Bas, a Bas Levi or a Bas Kohen, there's no Pinyin HaBen.
There's no Pinyin HaBen, right.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So, of course, there are other cases too. I mean, if the first child, you know, happens to be born by a cesarean section and it's a boy, that's another reason. Right, because it's not a heterorephim, born in the normal way. Okay?
All right.
Then, the next little statement that was there is Kohenis mitamor. Excuse me. Kohenis mischalelis, Kohen ein mischalel. Okay. We spoke about that last week. Problem about becoming a cholol, in other words, disqualified from officiating or from eating, particularly, would be disqualified from eating truma and things like that and so on. Why do we have this problem? This problem exists, first of all, because of the fact that according to the law in the Torah, what does it say about who is a kohen eligible to marry? It says, Isha, right? Right? That they're not allowed to marry a woman who is either, you know, a woman of evil repute. In other words, she doesn't have the world's greatest reputation. She's a zayna, right? Or a chalola. Now, how do we define the word chalola? We define a chalola as, you know, a woman who has, you know, she's the daughter, let's say, of a Kohen who married someone who is prohibited to him. Okay? For example, the Kohen would marry a Gerusha. Right. Kohen would marry a Gerusha.
Yeah.
Okay? So in that particular case, neither the woman, you know, can eat at the Matnas Kahuna, right? In other words, you can't give a truma and things like that. And at the same time, if he has children from her, so it wouldn't make any difference. If it's a male, it's a cholo, he's a cholo. Oh, and if he's if it's a girl, you know, then she's a cholo. Okay, and of course the kohen is not allowed to marry her. Okay? So.
Who's not allowed to marry her?
A kohen is prohibited to marry a chalola, right?
But anybody else can.
Yeah, anybody else can. I mean, she's a legitimate Jewish girl, but, you know, from the point of view of the special kedusha of a kohen, you know, so she's disqualified for that particular reason, okay? Now, but the question is, what happens if he goes ahead and he marries a woman he's not supposed to marry? It's a law in the Torah. I mean, the Torah says don't, right? He went and he did it. Now, we learned in Gemara and Kedushin, if we remember, that in that particular case, it's Kedushin Tevsin B'chayove Lavin, which means that the marriage is a valid marriage, technically, even though it contravenes a negative commandment in the Torah. Now, this is not the same as, you know, arroyos, in other words, you know, those things that prohibited relationships of the you know closeness in relationship or you know
sister
marriage
brother,
and so on right exactly sister brother aunt and so on
yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
you can go through you know the father's mother and so on and
all those
right in the case of stepchildren and so on and so forth you know it simply branches out into all kinds of areas okay but as far as over here is concerned, so the marriage was in contravention. Therefore what? So that therefore we learn that, you know, in this particular case, if it's a kohen who did it, then in that particular case, the child is not considered a mamzer. Child is not a mamzer. Child is a legitimate child, even though such a union should not have taken place. Because a mamzer is already a different story. A mamzer is the face of if a man has intercourse with a married woman who never was divorced from her husband, then that child, that offspring, you see, is a mamzer. Okay? So it's not the same thing. All right. But what happens to the Kohen? So his progeny, whether it's a son or a daughter, are going to be considered cholo. Even his wife is considered a cholola. But he himself is not a cholo. So the question is, why shouldn't he be a cholo? Right? That's exactly what the problem is. So the answer is, it says the omakro, menalon. How do we know this? It says omakro. We base it on the pasuk which says, "Velo yechalel zaro be'amov." Right? He is not to make kolo, in other words, to profane his seed among his people. So zaro mischalel, his seed will become kolo. They will become profane in this respect. But the who eino mischalel, he himself is not. And as I pointed out last week, from this point of view, whatever avoda, whatever priestly service he performs, let's say in the Beis HaMikdash, is not disqualified by virtue of the fact that he married someone that he had no business to marry. Okay?
That seems unusual, doesn't it? Because the wife suffers, the children suffer, but he's the one who did it, and he doesn't suffer.
Yeah. What does it mean, Kohen and Kohen? I mean,
it means that the daughter of that Kohen is Mischalelis. She becomes a Chalo, okay? Or if she herself married somebody that she had no business marrying, she is also considered Chalola, which means that she cannot eat Trumo and things like that. You understand?
But nothing happens to the Kohen.
But the Kohen himself is permitted to carry on. Now, I pointed out last week, I mean, for example, the problem of Duchening, okay? Would you disqualify a Kohen who marries a divorcee from Duchening? Technically, it's not to his credit that he's doing it. But nevertheless, if he goes up on the Duchen, he goes up on the Bima and he Duchens, we don't say that his Duchening is prohibited, because he's still carrying out an avoda which he is permitted to do.
They wouldn't allow him to talk in Muncie.
No, in Muncie, I'm sure they would. Right.
That his son could not go and get a woman?
That's correct. That's correct.
They would stop the son, but they wouldn't stop the son.
That's right, if they were applying the law. The average, look, you know, we're talking about congregations, and, you know, you have congregations, and some, they're aware of these things, and they wouldn't let such a coin go up. Even if they do, that technically he should, you understand?
No, but the halacha is the fact that he is allowed to.
He is allowed, right. Yeah, because we do have various rules in connection with duchening. And one of the rules is that he has to be merutze lakol. That means it has to be considered favorably by the congregation. So if the congregation considers him favorably, they don't raise any objections, they don't throw stones at him or whatever it may be.
Whether he's Shomer Shabbos or not, or what?
Yeah, correct. Whether he's Shomer Shabbos or not, exactly. But if the Kahal is not happy with such a kind, then it would be better that he doesn't go up to the
door. So how does he find out?
Tell us.
People
are going to get back to him and say, you know, I don't think that you should go up to Duchen, because I know that you know, you go into business on Shabbat.
Not
or whatever,
to go up to
Duchen.
What if he has a terrible voice and sings very loud?
Well, I think we have an idea as to who you're talking
about. No, I'm not.
It's not Louis Cohen.
Like, reasons that might disqualify a person from going up. I mean, could that be a fair reason?
Well, I don't think that in itself is. You know who's disqualified because of a voice? A Levi. Because, well, it depends, you know, what he's doing. But the Levium who would sing in the Beis HaMikdash, voice was one of the things that would disqualify a lady. It's koil is one thing, shonim is another thing, because according to the law, the Torah, the first 20 years or so are devoted, you know, he doesn't serve. Then after that, he has 5 years of training. Then after that, he serves, and then after he reaches a certain age, at that particular point, you know, at the age of 50,
he retires.
So this would be one of the things in the case of a Levi that would disqualify him from singing in the choir. But listen, I guess if he could bang a cymbal or something like that, maybe it wouldn't disqualify him. Because the Levium, they also had an orchestra in the Beis HaMikdash.
For sure.
Yeah. You know, trumpets, cymbals, whatever
they
used.
They played on Shabbos too.
Yes, because that was considered part of the Avodah.
Yeah.
Right. But the Gemara gives no reason why he's not disqualified, but his wife and children are.
It's only the strict interpretation of the Pasuk. Zaro Mischalil, his seed, because the Torah mentions
but
the word...
not Zaro.
Huh?
The wife is not Zaro. The wife
but,
is she.
But why does his seed become disqualified? Because he married a woman that he had no business with marrying.
Yeah, but the woman, why does she get disqualified?
You mean his wife?
Yeah,
but I'm telling you, if she is the one who he was not supposed to marry because
she's
of
the
halal. Right.
But
let's say she was a divorcee. She's the halal in that case. Okay.
But he's guilty. Why did he marry her? I mean, it seems like he should have some punishment.
Okay. Yeah. Technically, we learned. Right, right. Hold it. Technically, I have to go one step further. Technically, we learned that, frankly, he should divorce her because he should not be living with her in contravention to the law of the Torah. So...
He should divorce
her. Right, he should divorce her. This is what he should be doing, correctly. Okay.
Why he has children?
Yeah?
Why he has children?
But as I said, I mean, if he has children from her, so they become chalolim, but they're not mamzerim. They can marry, anybody, except a kohen.
She was not a married woman.
The only thing that doesn't make sense is the sense that the kids are halaling, but what the only thing that doesn't make sense is that she's a wife.
No, because she she was bia asura. Okay, he had marital relations with a woman who was prohibited to him. That's the reason. So that's why she became a halala. Okay.
But the onus was on him, and he committed the sin.
He was a bad guy.
He's a bad
but
guy.
He doesn't
suffer
anything.
Everybody around
yeah,
suffer.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Cool.
But sometimes bad guys get by because strict letter of the law.
Actually, a more general view of the law. He had to be willing, but maybe she enticed him.
Well, whatever it may be.
No.
Look, we don't know whether she enticed him or whether he enticed her, you know. We don't know the circumstances. He knew that, though, at least he should have known that there was a law that says, you know, that he's not allowed to marry Gerusha, because anybody who studies Parsha Emor is aware of
that. We come to the conclusion that, that it was a male society at that time.
No.
Right?
No. But as I say, it's based on a strict reading of the sentence. As we'll see over here, we have several strict readings now. And in many cases, they're going to say, we don't know why. But this is it. Okay, let's continue with the next one. Okay. Kohenis Mitama. All right, this is obvious, okay? Why should the daughter of the Kohen, she is allowed to observe all the laws of mourning, or, let's put it better, mourning, I mean, there's no question. I mean, that even a Kohen has to be Mitame, right? He has to literally make himself unclean or defile himself, whatever term you want to use for it, for his father, his mother, his wife, and so on and so forth, okay?
A child,
yes, okay. This we know, okay? Right. So, certainly, I mean, his wife too, or anybody, because we learned that all Jews are bound by this. The Kohen, in other words, what we have over there, the Parsha gives us the example for what a Jew does, you know, when he loses someone who is close to him, okay? But how about the business that a Kohen, we know, is not allowed to defile himself by having contact with the dead? You know, others. In other words, a Kohen is not allowed to go to the cemetery, okay? Mm-hmm. Kohen is not allowed, for example, to go into a funeral chapel. Something like that. Okay? I mean, wherever there is a roof, which we call, you know, an ohel, in other words, it spreads like a tent over him, then in that case, he could be defiled. So a Kohen is not allowed to do it. But how about the daughter of a Kohen? Is she allowed to go to a funeral? Allowed to go to the cemetery? The answer is absolutely yes. So this is what they're saying over here. Okay? In other words, they're saying Kohen is metama, right? But the Kohen is not metama, right? So my tama, what's the reason? So omakor, because again, we have a pasuk. What does the pasuk say? The pasuk says, Emor il hakohanim, right? Speak unto the Kohanim, Bnei Aharon, the sons, literally, of Aaron, right? So Bnei Aharon, yes, the sons of Aaron, they're not allowed to be metame for a mess, right? But the lo benos Aharon, not the daughters of Aaron, okay? So that they are not subject to these rules concerning Tumah. Okay. Next example. Kohen oichel b'kotshe kadoshim, but the Kohenis is not allowed to eat kotshe kadoshim. Now again, we have to once more define what we mean by kotshe kadoshim. Okay? Sacrifices come in different categories. Okay? Those that are termed kotshe kadoshim, they include three types of sacrifice. There's the oilo, there's the chatos, and there's the osho. Okay? Now, oilo, by its very term, means that it has to be completely burnt, so that, therefore, nobody eats of it. The whole thing is cut up into pieces, and so on, and then offered up on the mizbeah. Okay. The chatos, as we said, this is the sin offering brought when a person has committed a transgression, that he was unaware that he was doing wrong, but afterwards, when he realized that he had done wrong, then he brings this in order to atone for it. Okay, so there, what is the rule? The rule is that, besides those portions that are put on the altar, normally it would be, for example, the chalev, the dam, the blood, the aseres hakoved, and so on. Kaloyos, the kidneys, these are the things that are burnt on the altar, right? And the rest of it was eaten by the Kohanim, okay? A similar rule applied to Oshem. Oshem is what we call a transgression offering. It differs from the Chatos in that the Oshem is brought for certain specific actions. As for example, a person stole, right? And then he admits his guilt, okay? So not only does he have to make restitution, to the person from whom he has stolen, but he also has to bring a chatos, an oshem, in order to atone, right, to the redeemance, or whatever you want to say, all right, to secure atonement, for the sin which he has committed. And we have several other things mentioned, particularly in Vayikra, the end of the parsha Vayikra, where they deal with transgressions for which an oshem has to be brought. There are also some oshemas that are brought, even if it's not for a transgression, as for example, asham mitzora. When the Mitzora, the person who suffers from leprosy, finally is able to achieve, going back again into the fold, so to speak, and being able once more to resume life as a member of the community. So naturally, prior to that, he has to undergo certain rules and regulations that, for example, he has to be sprinkled with hyssop, and there has to be... then he has to bring sacrifices. So one of the sacrifices that he brings is an oshem. All right. But whatever the reason for the oshem, but nevertheless, the rule is the same. Part of the animal is going to be sacrificed on the altar, but the rest of the animal is going to be eaten by Kohanim. But these sacrifices differ from other sacrifices, what we would call the kochim kalim, right, the lighter types of sacred animals, as for example shlomim, peace offerings, todo, the thanksgiving offering, where in these cases it's specified that the altar gets something, the kohen gets something to eat, gets the chozer, for example, and this is it, okay. So he gets this part over there, and he gets, let's say, the foreleg or something like that, okay? And then the cheeks of the animal, I guess they like it. I know that today they use it, I think, for making delicatessen or something, right? So at any rate, these go to the Kohen, and the rest of the animal is eaten by the person who offers it, and the family, and you can invite anybody that you want, the levy, and that's open to everybody, you see, to come and enjoy and make it a festive meal. Okay, so what we're saying over here is, where is the pasuk? I mean, why that in the case of the kodshei kodoshim, in other words, specifically the chatas and the yoshim, to which I will also add one other thing, and that is the bechor, the firstborn animal, which also goes to the kohen. In all of those cases, it's only the male kohanim who are permitted to eat it. So we got a pasuk. What is the pasuk? The pasuk is kol zochor, right? Every male, bivnei Aaron, among the descendants of Aaron, yochlen, can eat it. So, in other words, when it says kol zochor, specifically over there, then it means only males are permitted to eat those particular sacrifices. Okay. Yeah.
Why did they have to specify kol zochor bivnei Aaron if bivnei Aaron is sufficient to mean bivnei Aaron below Pnosa?
You ask a very good question. But I don't have an answer for that. But it shows you, you know, that you could argue this way, that, and so on, because whatever. Right, right. Right, right, right. You're absolutely right, right. But nevertheless, this is what the pasuk says, and the pasuk specifically singles out over here, okay?
Sons.
Right.
No, actually, they wanted their wives to represent them.
All right. Okie dokie. All right. Then the next one is, says, you know, what is it? Ish Isha. Okay. Now, the Mishnah gave a series of different things between, you know, rules, dinim that apply to a man and to a woman where there is a difference. Other things, I mean, men and women follow the same dinim. Okay. We take a look over here. Yeah. Alright. The example that they bring over here is for Ish Poreya Uforeim, right? The Yeno Ish Poras Uforemus. Okay. And this is what they will discuss right now for a moment. Okay. The rule is that a person who suffers leprosy, right, has to be placed, so to speak, in quarantine. Okay? But in addition, you know, to living apart from the rest of the community at this particular point, he or she, because women also could suffer leprosy, right? So they have to observe certain rules. But these rules apply to the man and not to the woman. What is the rule that applies to it? So the answer is that the Torah says that a leper has to be poreya, in other words, he